We're talking typeface here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The font you choose says more about you than you may think. We're looking at the effects of typography on our emotions, and just a ballpark figure here, there are perhaps 300,000 fonts in our world. A lot to pick from. We surveyed some of our colleagues on the ones they prefer.
Gotham. It just goes well with everything.
Universe. It's a practical face that you can use for many things.
Verdana? It's just always been like my go-to.
Garamond is the most professional font.
You can't trust someone who uses Comic Sans.
Do you have strong feelings about fonts? Which ones do you love and which ones do you loathe and why? Do you have a story about using the wrong font? Join in at 800-642-1234. Sarah Hindman is a graphic designer and author of several books about typeface, including Why Fonts Matter. Sarah, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
We just heard that montage of voices there on fonts. And the question we had posed to the people was, you know, whom would you hire based on what font they used? And there, people had pretty strong opinions. Why is it that we're able to pass judgment when the only information we have about someone is their font?
I think this is so interesting. As human beings, whenever we encounter a new situation, we make really instant snap judgments. And when you're looking at typefaces, at fonts, or what you're doing is you're looking at them in the same way that you would think about what somebody wearing, what's their body language telling you, what does their facial expression communicate to you. So we make all of these really instantaneous judgments. But then we also have these associations we make with different typefaces. For example, Gotham has gathered a lot of associations over the last few years. So we have both of these things that actually give us a huge amount of information.
What are some associations we've made with Gotham?
So Gotham really came to fame, I would say, in around 2008. When Obama was running for president and his campaign was all about change. And the typographic political landscape at the time had a lot of much more traditional typefaces, the serif typefaces with the feet on them that talk about knowledge, history, knowledge and history. Whereas Gotham is a very clean sans serif typeface. It doesn't have those little feet. Although it's actually been designed very much inspired by mid-20th century typefaces. So it still has that notion of history, but it's modern history. But you put that against the other typefaces at the time, and the campaign didn't just say change. The actual shape of the words it used embodied this whole idea of change.
Wow, that's a lot riding on the back of a font there. We're packing in a lot of meaning. I mean, there is a lot of meaning that you see in fonts. It's common knowledge that if you want to be taken seriously, you shouldn't use Comic Sans. So how do these associations come to be?
Firstly, every time you see a typeface, you make lots of assumptions from the context that you see it in. So Comic Sans, there's kind of a hint in its name. It's got the word comic in it. Mm-hmm. It's inspired by comic books. So most of the time you would see it in comic or childlike scenarios. So if you suddenly see it in a different scenario, you might think that it feels a little bit out of place. It's like an actor being miscast in a film. It won't feel true. It won't ring true. And there are really lovely stories. One of my favorites is that when CERN announced the discovery of the Higgs boson particle, the God particle. So this is one of the biggest scientific discoveries of our lifetimes. They announced it in Comic Sans.
Oh,
and on
my goodness.
Twitter, within minutes, it was Comic Sans that was actually trending on Twitter higher than the discovery of the scientific of the Higgs boson particle.
So one of most sophisticated science lab in the world, CERN in Switzerland, is using Comic Sans, which is such a contrast to really the integrity of what's going on there.
So that's what was everybody was saying on Twitter. But of course, this is just Twitter, and it doesn't really devalue the discovery for one moment. And when the director was asked, she said, well, we just wanted it to look like handwriting. And the whole idea, a lot of the time people will use Comic Sans because they don't want to feel pressured into actually thinking about designing typefaces. They just want to write something. So in those kind of scenarios, you can understand why it gets used.
Talking with Sarah Hindman, she's a graphic designer, and we're talking about the impact of typography on our lives. You can join in this conversation, 800-642-1234. And graphic designers out there, what are your thoughts on typography? Why does it matter? How does it affect the work you do? Call in. You can also email ideas at WPR.org. Sarah, how does all of this apply to marketing and the way that companies choose to portray their products and what, in the end, what we choose to buy? Do fonts matter that much?
They, in my opinion, they do, because that's what I do for a living. And also, if you just look around any shop, you will see that there is such a huge range of different typographic voices that clearly it must matter, otherwise people wouldn't put money into doing this. One of the first things that you do, especially if you go into a supermarket, is you will filter out the things that you don't want to buy, or you will just look for the things that you do want to buy. And one of the ways you will do that is looking for the appropriate typefaces. If you want cheap bargain, you know that these will be the big, bold, uppercase, blocky typefaces, probably in really bright colors. If you want the more luxurious, the more expensive version of something, you will probably look for more finesse typefaces where there's a bit more space around them. They might be smaller, they might be more spaced out. And these are instant visual codes that cue you into the first level of how you're navigating your way around your life.
Are there trends in fonts? Because we have the sense that sans serif is the font to use right now, and Google changed its logo to sans serif font in 2015. Are there trends setting companies, or are there trend lines in fonts?
Really interesting question. And the answers that people were giving on when you queued this up, I noticed most of those were sans serif typefaces. Mm. Yes, there are absolutely trends. I think these, a lot of the times, these come more from cultural attitudes. And so one of the things I do is I look at the way typefaces have changed over the centuries. And once you match these up to what was happening in the wider social historical world, you start to get a real sense of how they map change. So what we've had in the last 10 years or so is, thanks to iPhones, we've had this real love affair with technology and how much it can do, and social media. And also because screens in the early days of all of this weren't very high quality, sans serif typefaces were much easier to read. We're now coming to an end of that trend where people are now wanting things that feel more in tune with nature, that are a bit more local. It feels like there's a little bit of a move away from big business, big corporate, big tech companies, and wanting something that's a little bit more personal. So we're seeing, almost in the same way that we saw the 1950s was when modernism and all these sans serif typefaces were really having their heyday.
Mm-hmm.
And then two decades later in the 70s, everything looked really hand-painted. It was all very natural. And it feels like we're going through quite a similar trend, quite a similar path now. So you have yogurts and different brands having these really nice, voluptuous serif typefaces that feel like they've come from the 1970s.
Talking with Sarah Hindman. She's a graphic designer, author of several books about typeface. Your thoughts as well, 800-642-1234. What is your story about a favorite font? Let's talk about it in a minute here on the Ideas Network. We're looking at the impact that typography has on our lives. It's The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Apparently, curvy fonts are on trend right now as brands are moving away from tidy sans serif. They're embracing more of a funky 70s vibe. That's it. Groovy, curvy, smooth typefaces have more expressive human feel, and corporate branding people are game for that. Do you have strong feelings about fonts? Which ones do you love? Which ones do you loathe? And why? Designers out there, how do fonts impact your work? We're at 800-642-1234. You can join in. Sarah Heinemann stays with us. She is a graphic designer and the author of several books about typeface. Let's go to the phones now with Carol joining us from Chippewa Falls. Hi, Carol.
Good morning.
Go ahead.
Yes, I enjoy using Tahoma because it's just, for me, visually easier to read.
So when you see Tahoma font, or how do you use that font?
I just use it every day.
Mm-hmm.
It seems like it's thicker.
Okay. Yeah, so it has nice differences between thick and thin lines. So what do we know, Sarah, about Tahoma?
It's one of the typefaces that has very much been designed to work well on screen. A lot of the more traditional, the older typefaces were designed for print. So that would make a lot of sense why you would use it almost like your on-screen version of handwriting. And once you get used to it, it's something that you will find easy to read, and it sounds like it's quite a practical choice to make.
How can fonts affect the way we interpret what we're reading, and in particular in books?
Oh, very interesting. There's been quite a lot of research done that shows that we make really, really instant assumptions. So we will assume that something might be more intelligent. And when we read that book, we read it through that filter. And we will actually, it has been proven that we will find it more intelligent. There have been studies where they've got people to read newspapers in different typefaces. And some typefaces will make, say, the New York Times feel more satirical than other typefaces. So it's just this filter through which we read something.
So do publishers tend to use the same fonts, or are there particular go-to fonts that publishers use for books, or are there variations?
There seem to be variations depending on the publishers. If you're a traditional publisher who has a particular look that you will always want to stick to, so you have a house style,
mm-hmm.
then they will use pretty similar typefaces. Others will pair the typefaces because it will be the voice of the book.
Mm.
And so each book will actually have its own signature language or its own voice.
You did this project a few years back where you asked people to look at a set of fonts and choose which one they'd want to date. What were you hoping to find out there?
I play lots and lots of games that are, everything I do is all about showing people that we don't have to take typography seriously all of the time, and that actually all of us already understand what fonts mean. And rather than me just asking a question like, what do you think of Times New Roman? If I say Times New Roman, Arial, Comic Sans, Snog, Marry, Avoid, and I start asking people, which one would you go on a date with? You suddenly find that even people who go, I know nothing, they suddenly have an answer and can also give you a whole backstory about the personality of that typeface if you give a fun and mischievous scenario.
And then suddenly you find out the backstory of the person themselves and their personality.
It does. The things that the associations we make, absolutely, they reveal a lot about the context in which we've learned all of these things. So I also have another game where I show you a particular spiky black letter on a record, and I ask you what kind of music. And for me, I would say heavy metal, but then I show it to other people and they would say, no, it's hip hop, or somebody else would say, no, it's Taylor Swift, or somebody else would say, no, it's Wagner. So a lot of the assumptions we make, yes, you're right, they absolutely reflect a huge amount about us.
And it's so interesting how our eye can pick up subtle changes to fonts. When a company decides to change their logo, they change their font, and we notice we can pick up these subtle variations. Why is that?
Presumably because you know that logo well enough that you will actually see. And also, we're creatures of habit. Once something's familiar, we don't really like change that much. So it takes us a little bit of time to get used to it. When it's a company like Google, their reputation precedes them. Frankly, they could put their logo in Comic Sans and it would be lots and lots of talking, but nobody would stop using Google because of that. Whereas a much more unknown company, your typeface really is the voice. It really is the first impression. So it becomes much more important that you make the right choices at that level.
Sarah, here's a great question from Phil from Soldiers Grove, and he called in to ask how fonts get their names. Some of them seem really weird or silly, he says. Like Tahoma, where do these names come from?
I don't actually know where the name Tahoma came from, but the naming of fonts almost mirrors history. So original, really early ones were just named after the people who had designed them. And then you have this amazing time in the 1800s when display typefaces were going completely mad, and they were named after to fashions. So Egyptian artifacts were really popular at one point. So a style of typeface was called Egyptian, not because it had anything to do with Egypt, but because it was a trendy name and it was a good marketing tool. More recently, we have people like Jonathan Barmbrook who name his typefaces with really unusual names that are meant to make you stop and notice them. So they're almost little campaigns in the actual font naming. Ones like Gotham's a good example, because this was designed by Tobias Frere Jones, and he loves mid-20th century typefaces from New York. So Gotham is obviously New York in the Batman movies.
Sure, yeah. So I wanted to know how many fonts there are in the world, and of course you Google that, and there are hundreds of thousands of fonts. Is that true?
Yes, and as we're speaking, there'll be another one being designed. Oh, and there's another one. It's easier than ever these days, thanks to technology, to design typefaces. Some of them will take like years to develop because they need to have all of the different families. But others, if it's just a quick display typeface, you can create one yourself. So they are constantly new ones appearing.
What makes a font stand the test of time?
Oh, interesting. I think some, like Helvetica, because they are just practical workhorses almost. I'm sure I'm going to get complaints for saying that. but they're versatile enough that they can fit into most situations. Others will come and go. So we will have an era where particular style of serifs are being used. They will fall out of fashion, then they might come back into fashion again. There's also the technology. So at the moment, because we're looking at much smaller screens, typefaces are designed to actually fit within the technology, which is also why new ones are constantly being designed, because every time technology changes, we need more. We need typefaces that work with that technology. We're human beings. We just like to express ourselves.
Do you find as a designer you get in a rut perhaps and keep going back to the same typefaces, or do you force yourself to explore a bit, to branch out?
That's another good question. I would say in my early career I had a palette of certain typefaces I would use. As time has gone on, I now very much work with the client. I work on the project, and I look at what is going to be the right tone of voice for that project. And even if that means using a typeface that I might not personally like so much, if it's right and if it's appropriate, then that's what we would go with.
I used to work with a designer who always was talking about the thicks and the thins of a particular font. You have to get the right thicks and thins. Is the heft of a font, does that have a lot of impact on what you're trying to communicate?
That absolutely does. So one thing would be legibility, and another one is that things like prestige, there are certain concepts that will be conveyed. So the typefaces that would be at the top end, so I do lots of surveys and lots of experiments. The typefaces that are at the top end of the prestige scale are ones that have fine hairline details, or that would have extreme thick and thin contrast. So it looks like a lot of craft has gone into these. Mm-hmm. The ones at the lower, the cheaper end of the scale will be the really bold ones, maybe with no contrast, maybe with curved corners, so they look a little bit more like they've been drawn with a chunky felt tip pen.
So as we start to close here, what's up with the 70s vibe that's going on and like all of these curvy and kind of curvy, smooth typefaces? Is there a revival going on to the 70s?
It looks like there is. Flares are coming back in, which I'm not wearing again. but I think if you look also at just what's happening generally, we are beginning to, we're loving nature. We're loving air. We're moving away from wanting everything to be too high tech. Mm. And that's very much what was happening in the 70s. And a lot of the 70s typefaces are actually originally Art Nouveau typefaces, which is, again, another time when we were embracing nature and paint.
Yeah.
So I think it's just things are cyclical and this is coming back again.
Sarah, thank you so much for joining us.
Pleasure.
Sarah Hindman is a graphic designer, author of several books about typeface, including Why Fonts Matter. And we've been talking about the impact of typography on human emotions. Coming up, Uber and Lyft drivers in several major cities plan to strike tomorrow morning. We're asking about working conditions here in the Midwest. We'll talk about it after this news update. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. Drivers for the ride-hailing companies Uber and Lyft are striking tomorrow over working conditions and wages, and we're talking about it here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Uber and Lyft are these ride-hailing apps that allow people to order a private or shared car with a few taps of a mobile app, with payment taken automatically from a user's account, and they've been seen as more convenient than hailing a traditional cab. 15 million Uber trips are completed each day with several million Uber drivers worldwide. And its key rival, Lyft, has 1.4 million drivers. Do you drive for Uber, Lyft, or another ride-hailing service? What is that experience like? We're at 800-642-1234. Arun Sundarrajan is a professor at New York University's Stern School of Business. He's the author of The Sharing Economy, The End of Employment, and the Rise of Crowd-Based Capitalism. And his research explores how digital technologies impact business, government, and civil society. Arun, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Great to be back, Kate.
Well, break this down for us. Why exactly are Lyft and Uber drivers striking tomorrow?
Well, we've had two high-visibility IPOs of the parent companies, Lyft a few weeks ago and Uber on Friday. I think the specter of a number of executives and early investors getting fabulously wealthy is perhaps particularly galling to Uber and Lyft drivers who are not earning a lot of money per hour doing what they're doing. But I also think it's part of a broader conversation about, the growing divide between technology platforms and the millions of people they empower to sort of make a living through the platform. In the 20th century, we created this social safety net across the country, but we did it for one particular arrangement of work, full-time employment. And the kind of work that's being created by the new technology platforms doesn't look like full-time employment. It looks different. And so it frustrates a lot of workers who are looking for the benefits, the security, and the safety that and the stability that used to be associated with full-time work. And so I think that's sort of really what's bubbling to the surface here.
Right. Independent contractors are feeling pretty exposed here. What kind of impact could the strike have on these companies? Because these work stoppages, it looks like, are only about 2 hours in major cities. But is that enough to make an impact?
Well, I think the fact that we're speaking about it on your show today is a big part of the impact they were hoping for. It's less about a financial hit that they're trying to induce on the company and more about just simply drawing attention. The trouble is that we're not talking about a situation here where the management is oblivious to the issues that labor is facing and need to be brought to the table. Rather, both Uber and Lyft actively think about how to improve relationships with drivers. It's just that they are also in a situation where they're going public. They're trying to sort of demonstrate that they have a viable business model. And so it's a balancing act for the companies between, you know, sort of making sure that their relationship with drivers is decent and also convincing earners, convincing investors that they can sort of like, you know, turn profits soon. So will it have an impact? I think it already has. Will it sort of lead to sudden change, a drop in the Uber IPO price? Probably not.
Arun, the drivers' union has asked for better job security and a guarantee that drivers receive 80 to 85% of fares. What changes do you think are realistic for the rideshare drivers and what they're asking?
Well, I think we need to sort of separate how much the drivers get paid from the other sources of security and stability. You know, there's generally a feeling that over time, the commission rates that the platforms take, that is for every dollar that you or I spend on an Uber or Lyft, what fraction does the platform keep and how much gets passed through to the driver, that those commission rates will come down to 10 or 15% over time, not because of drivers, like, you know, labor activism, but simply because of competition. You know, the platforms that offer lower commissions will be the ones that attract the drivers. So I believe that that will happen over time. It's not automatically going to raise, like, you know, sort of driver earnings to sort of a really impressive level. I mean, this is fundamentally not a form of work that is going to be extremely lucrative, like, you know, even in the long run. But I think what most drivers seem to want, in addition to sort of better wages, is some feeling of stability. There's a very contingent feeling about, like, you know, not knowing how much you're going to earn next month, about not being able to afford health insurance, about not being able to take paid vacations. I mean, this is not just Uber and Lyft drivers. I mean, a growing fraction of the workforce is in these work arrangements that don't have this kind of stability and protection. And the answer really isn't going to come from exclusively from the platforms, because we've just got to rethink how we fund this social safety net. You know, when everybody was a full-time employee, it made sense to think about, okay, here's what the employer does, here's what the employee does, here's what the government does. But as we move into a world where more and more people are earning a living in these not quite employment, but sort of dependent on a technology platform relationships, we have to restructure who's responsible for what in funding, like, you know, the stability, the safety, and the predictability that all of us crave.
We're talking with Arun Sundararajan. He's a professor at New York University Stern School of Business, and you can join in this conversation. Do you drive for Uber, Lyft, or another ride-hailing service? What is that experience like? Are you satisfied with your wages and hours? What changes would you like to see? And perhaps have you considered organizing? Do you support the efforts of your fellow drivers? We're at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Arun, these sharing economy type companies that you've been talking about, they have been technology disruptors. Companies like Uber have upended the traditional taxi industry. Companies like Airbnb are perhaps threatening the hotel industry. But that has also come at a cost to workers. What does the fact that the gig economy workers are organizing and using their voices, what does that say to you?
I think it's a good sign. I think it's it's coming at a time where labor voice is perhaps sort of at its lowest level of power that it's been in 50 years. Like, these issues have been sort of bubbling beneath the surface for at least a couple of decades. I think Uber, ironically, will perhaps also, when we look back in 10 years, we'll think of them as the company that really brought, like, you know, the 21st century labor law issues to the fore. Because, you know, they're not the first company where, you know, workers have asked to be reclassified as employees rather than independent contractors. Companies ranging from FedEx to even Microsoft have faced these kinds of class action lawsuits. But because it's Uber, we're paying so much more attention. It sort of rallies workers in a way that we haven't seen happen. I do distinguish between Uber and Lyft on the one hand and Airbnb on the other, because, you know, the nature of the relationship that Airbnb hosts have with Airbnb is pretty different. I mean, you know, the 6 million hosts on Airbnb really are tiny entrepreneurs who are running little businesses through the platform and who, by and large, seem to feel positively about the platform. I think the impact on hotel workers in the long run will be significant, but this sort of underscores the fact that we're looking at entering a new economy where we can't expect that everybody is going to have a full-time job. That's just not the way the economic activity will be organized. And more people will be earning a living through either independent work or running a small business through a platform. And we really just have to step up. And, you know, the federal government has to step up over the next few years, state and local governments, and saying, well, how do we refund the social safety net that we funded using full-time employment in the 20th century?
Arun, is it in the best interest for these drivers to have the company they work for, the app they work for, to go public? Because we saw Lyft went public earlier this year and didn't do so well in trading, you know, looking from March to now. You know, what about going public? Is it in the best interest for drivers?
It depends on the choices that the platform makes after they go public. I think both Uber and Lyft took sort of a small step towards sharing the ownership of the platform with their drivers. They've made token gestures to say that, you know, if you've driven, like, you know, more than 10,000 rides, more than 20,000 rides, here's sort of money to buy shares. Here's a way in which you can also participate in the ownership of the platform. You know, this is not going to result in drivers owning big chunks of the platform, but it's a step forward. I think that's a direction they should pursue aggressively, because the platform that actually decentralizes its ownership more is going to naturally, you know, get more driver hours, get a greater feeling of, you know, sort of belonging and loyalty from the drivers. You know, I know that's a far cry from, you know, the state we are in today where, you know, drivers want to go on strike, and where a majority of the drivers, while they are happy about the fact that they can make a living through these platforms, are not happy about the level of earnings they're getting. But, you know, so if the platforms after going public are too sensitive to investor pressures, if they sort of chase after short-term earnings and start to try and cut costs and cut driver earnings in the process, this is not going to be a good thing. If their leaders are strong enough to say, hey, we're playing the long game, you know, we're not after the taxi industry, we're really after trying to get people to stop buying cars and use our service. You know, the way that, you know, I often look at the way Amazon evolved over the last 20 years, Amazon.com, the online retailer.
Yeah.
Because, you know, they had a profitable business selling, you know, books.
And
music.
We have to pause right there. Arun Sundararajan, our guide, is a professor at NYU's Stern School of Business and talking about the ride hailing companies Uber and Lyft. We'll be back in just a minute here on the Ideas Network. We're talking about the ride-hailing apps Uber and Lyft here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and they're considered a disruptive business, have wreaked havoc on the taxi industry in major cities around the world. Now Uber and Lyft drivers are planning a strike tomorrow. Here is YouTube influencer Torsten Kuhnert, who's known as the rideshare professor. He was talking up Milwaukee a few years ago.
If you are thinking of joining Uber in Milwaukee, all I can say is congratulations. It's a fantastic company to work for. They have a lot of market share. They have a lot of drivers. Their cash flow is insane.
But is the cash flow that good as drivers this week strike on wages and working conditions? Do you drive for Uber, Lyft, or another ride-hailing service? What is that experience like? Are you satisfied with your wages, your hours? What changes would you like to see? We're at 800-642-1234. Arun Sundarajan stays with us. He's a professor at New York University's Stern School of Business. Arun, as we were wrapping up there before the break, you were saying how Uber and Lyft really have to look at the long game here. It's not about the immediate going after the taxi industry. It's more of a long-term vision about how we get from point A to point B and whether we even have cars.
Absolutely, Kate. And I was drawing a parallel with how Amazon has, over the last 20 years, gradually changed our shopping behaviors. They started out with books and CDs and DVDs. But Jeff Bezos didn't say, okay, I figured out how to sell these to consumers profitably. Let me sort of, you know, double down on this and focus on earnings. Over the decade or more after Amazon went public, the company continually kept investing in gradually changing our behaviors, gradually getting us comfortable with buying more and more of our stuff through the Amazon platform. Now we buy everything ranging from consumer packaged goods to groceries. And this was the path to them becoming a $1 trillion company, the sort of stomach to face investor pressure, to report either poor earnings or losses for over a decade, while continually reinvesting in behavior change and growing the business. And this is really what Uber and Lyft need to do. While maintaining a good relationship with their drivers for the next decade, because the driverless cars aren't coming for a while, they also have to, you know, sort of weather this investor pressure and say, well, today, only 1% of U.S. consumer spending on personal transportation flows through Uber and Lyft. A vast majority of the remaining 99% is spent on buying new and used cars and maintaining them. And we've got to go after sort of getting a double-digit percentage of that personal transportation spend. That's what's going to make us the $1 trillion company.
And so you see them as having a lot more opportunity to expand, and perhaps that's what investors see through this IPO.
Absolutely. But, you know, there are going to be some investors who are saying sort of show me the money, show me that the business model is profitable, just like they were with Amazon back in the late 90s. And, it's going to be a test of the leadership of both Uber and Lyft as to whether they can sort of push back and say, don't worry about the earnings now, let's focus on the long run. And Lyft has historically had a better relationship with their drivers than Uber. Uber has been trying to improve them over the last 2 years, but you know, it's a complex balancing act for them, where on the one hand, they've got the investors saying, like, you know, can you charge higher commissions? On the other hand, you've got the CEO saying, you know, we want to improve relationships with drivers. And so, you know, it remains to be seen what, you know, where they fall in, you know, sort of making sure that, you know, the people who actually power the profits of the company feel good about the company. And these are the drivers. And I think it's critical for them in the long run. You know, it would be a mistake for them to try and cut driver earnings in order to feed those short-term investor expectations.
Have we seen litigation against these companies in the past, and how are they dealing with that?
There's been a tremendous amount of litigation against these companies. I mean, I think like 5 years in, Google probably had a small legal team and nobody in government relations. Uber, on the other hand, had a massive legal team and probably like 1 in 10 people was working in government relations. And a lot of this has centered around whether like drivers are full-time employees or whether drivers are independent contractors. I think that the company started out by not handling these lawsuits well, but I think they've grown more sophisticated over time. You know, the important thing here is to focus the conversation not on classification, but on the broader issue of saying everybody wants a social safety net. Everybody wants benefits, stability, protection. In the economy of the future, we don't have a funding model for this. And so let's not worry too much about classification. Let's instead come up with a broader way for, like, you know, how much does the platform pay? How much does the government pay? How much does the individual pay in actually funding the safety net that the drivers aspire to? Because, you know, Uber drivers or, you know, other freelance workers don't necessarily want the structure of full-time employment. It's not as if they want to be employees. They want the nice things that go with full-time employment. And if we can sort of pare away some of those nice things and attach them to other work arrangements, we'll have a happier and more productive workforce.
Arun, many people listening might be thinking, well, I don't drive for Uber or Lyft. I don't use these services. Why should I care right now? How would you respond to that?
Well, the rearrangement of work, if it hasn't already come to your industry, is on its way. I think people who work for the hotel industry have certainly started to face the pressure from, you know, the changes caused by Airbnb. Across a range of professional services, lawyers, consultants, accountants, public relations, digital marketing, high-end computer programming, we've seen the emergence of small but successful platform businesses that are allowing individuals to make money sort of running their own tiny business, so to speak. So there's a platform called UpCouncil, for example, that allows you to run your tiny law practice through the platform. But it's not like sort of hanging up a shingle and, you know, waiting for business to come. The platform helps you generate global demand the way Airbnb does for your little sort of bed and breakfast business that you're running through the platform. I fully expect that this model will start to have an impact on healthcare, on energy production in 10 years, on certain sort of slices of manufacturing. So it's certainly not a problem that's just restricted to Uber and Lyft drivers. In many ways, they are the leading indicator of the challenges to the safety net and the challenges to labor law that lie ahead for many of us in the decades to come.
So as we look at this strike as it heads tomorrow and Uber's IPO later this week, what are you going to be watching for in all of this?
Well, one of the things that I'm going to be trying to understand is what is the level of participation of Uber drivers and Lyft drivers in this strike? Because I believe that it's really important for a healthy economy to have strong worker voice. And we had it in the 50s and 60s, but the union model that emerged then hasn't really sort of kept up with the changes in work, you know. I think the organizing of Uber and Lyft workers is, you know, the first significant, you know, emergence of a different sort of worker collective, a worker collective for the 21st century, for the digital economy. But they don't have the kind of power that a traditional union has on its members. And so one of the things I will be watching with the strike is how much participation did they get? How much has this collective convinced its potential members that they do, in fact, represent them? Do they only represent a vocal minority, or do they actually represent sort of like, you know, the broader base of Uber and Lyft drivers?
Arun, thank you so much for joining us.
Of course, Kate. I mean, always great to be on your show.
Arun Sundaranjan is a professor at New York University's Stern School of Business. He wrote the book, The Sharing Economy, The End of Employment, and the Rise of Crowd-Based Capitalism. Coming up, a pair of frac sand mining companies in Trempealeau County are being sued by dozens of landowners. We'll look at the conflict after this news update. It's The Morning Show. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network.